Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey! Are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet GreenLight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/ACAST. That's greenlight.com/ACAST.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and in the early hours of Monday the 10th of June, these are our main stories. The French President Emmanuel Macron has called a snap parliamentary poll after his alliance was on course for a big defeat to the far right in European Union elections. The Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz has quit the government and called for the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to set a date for elections. Doctors at one of the last functioning hospitals in the besieged Sudanese city of El Fasher say they've been forced to close it down. Also in this podcast...
With his sailor suit and little bow tie, the white duck with the orange feet and bill has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
The Disney cartoon character Donald Duck is 90 years old. The French President Emmanuel Macron has called a snap parliamentary vote after his alliance was on course for a big defeat to the far right in European Union elections. As we record this podcast, the results from the polls have started to come in. So far, it's clear that on the whole, parties of the right and far right are gaining ground. We'll hear from Germany shortly, and also our Europe editor. But we start in France, where President Macron gave a television address on Sunday evening, saying he couldn't pretend nothing had happened.
J'ai décidé de vous redonner le choix de notre avenir.
I have decided to give you the choice for our parliamentary future by giving you a vote. I am therefore dissolving the National Assembly tonight. This is a serious decision. It is heavy, but it is first and foremost an act of confidence. Confidence in you, my fellow citizens, confidence in the capacity of the French people to make a choice that is right for them and for future generations.
I spoke to our correspondent in the French capital, Hugh Schofield, who says the French president's move has taken everybody by surprise.
It's come as a real shock. Even the pundits were surprised. Even those who follow French politics from the inside were surprised. He's done it, I think, for at least two reasons, one of which is that the state of politics was just getting too tense. It's being pulled apart. The reality of the country is not reflected in the institutions, and something had to give. He decided that rather than going on and continuing with this, growing opposition to him in the country, as reflected by this massive vote of the hard right today, he had to go back to the people and redraw up the representation in Parliament. To do otherwise would have meant for him another period in power, which would have been rendered absolutely impossible by the constant tensions over legislation. He already hasn't got a majority in Parliament. He was already having to scrabble to get anything through. Any fight in Parliament would now, with such a big vote moral victory for the hard right, would be very, very hard to get through and very quickly spill onto the streets, I think, as it has before already on the pensions vote and so on. So that's one reason. I think the other reason is that it's in his nature to do the unexpected, to take people by surprise, to put people on their back foot. He loves to see himself as a kind of D'Artagnan-like figure who will suddenly spring a shock on his opponents and on the country, and he hopes that that will kind of galvanise enough people into keeping out the hard right at these elections. But it's a very, very risky strategy.
Well, you've outlined there the difficulties he currently has, but isn't he taking a big risk in that this could make things even worse for him?
There's no guarantee that he will get what he wants. What he wants, what he's sort of banking on, is that if enough good people, in his view, you know, turn to the country and say, look, we're in this situation, we need to get a new majority, one of what he would call Republican values, and give it to us. And he's hoping then that there will be alliances possible between his party, the Renaissance, in the centre, and some on the right, some on the left. So a new government forming which would keep out the hard right. But there's absolutely no guarantee of that at all. Nothing suggests that anyone is a mind to do that. I mean, these potential partners haven't been at all willing to join up with him, particularly in the 2 years since he was re-elected in 2022. So why would they want to do it now? The constant warnings about the hard right just around the corner have worked up to a point in keeping, you know, the sort of centre in power, but those warnings just don't rub off on people anymore. I mean, when 32% of the country vote for the hard right and another 5% for another hard right party, that's sort of 40%. So 4 out of 10 people vote for the hard right. When there are parts of the country out from the big cities where it's more like 6 out of 10 people have voted for the hard right, you realise that, you know, the country is a different place from what it might appear in the heads of the metropolitans, and that's certainly the argument constantly being put out by the national rally, that they do represent more people now. And you know, quite clearly they do, if you look at these elections.
Hugh Schofield in France. In Germany, the far right has also made substantial gains. The anti-immigration Alternative for Germany, AfD, has overtaken Chancellor Olaf Scholz's centre-left coalition. According to a projection for German public television, the AfD is on track to come in second, behind the main conservative CDU-CSU opposition alliance. This assessment from our correspondent in Berlin, Damian McGuinness.
This is a disaster for German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, much worse than was expected, partly because, as well, disastrous for him personally, because his face was all over the country on those election posters. He really pushed himself forward in the campaign, even though he's not running itself in the European Union parliamentary elections. But he was the big face of the campaign. So this really is on him, this big defeat. And I think what we're going to see now are there's already been a lot of internal wrangling within the three coalition parties, within that very argumentative coalition. We're going to see even more arguments within that coalition, because each of those parties now is going to be fighting for survival, with key regional elections coming up in eastern Germany in September. They're going to be tough, because the AfD could well become the strongest force. The far right could well become the strongest force in those three elections. And of course, we've got the national elections next year. And so when you have a three-way coalition, which anyway, you know, is already an uneasy alliance, and if all three of those parties are feeling with their backs to the wall, they're going to fight even harder for their grassroots voters, and they're going to fight even harder for what they feel they believe and what they want in order to stay alive effectively. So we're going to have a rocky time here in Germany politically, and I think we're going to see some a particularly difficult time for the government. And of course, this is now shifted to the right, essentially. The Conservatives are in theory the leaders, but you know, they've only got 30%. This was once a very powerful party, so they're not doing quite as well as they should be doing, given how unpopular the government is. The real winners are the far right, the AfD, who are incredibly radical, and everyone's surprised they've done as well as they have done, given the number of scandals connected to them, and a new upstart, anti-migrant radical left party, which is also eating into those mainstream voters. So a lot going on in German politics, and I think it's just going to get rockier going forward over the next year with those big elections coming up.
Damian McGuinness. The success of right-wing and nationalist parties has not been restricted to France and Germany. In Austria, the far-right Freedom Party appears to have made history by topping the national poll for the first time. And the right has also scored some successes elsewhere. Here's our Europe editor, Katia Adler.
First of all, it's worth pointing out that, yes, this has been a vote for the European Parliament, but for many EU voters, be they in Barcelona, Berlin or elsewhere, Brussels can seem pretty far away from their everyday. So they tend to use this election to deliver a protest vote against their own national parliament. in the end, with partial results in, it looks like the centrist party still have a majority. But yes, big gains for the hard right and the far right as well, with voters worried about migration, inflation and the cost of environmental reforms. But whether those parties can influence EU policy on that will depend on their ability to club together, to unite, to have enough clout. And that will be tricky because there are a lot of differences between them. Take Ukraine, for example. Take Marine Le Pen. She traditionally is softer on Moscow. She'd like to work with the party of Giorgia Meloni, Italy's prime minister. But Ms. Meloni is passionate about helping Ukraine and about continuing to send arms there. So working together on that would prove tricky.
Katia Adler in Brussels. Next to Israel. A key member of the country's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, has resigned.
Netanyahu is preventing us from approaching true victory, which is the justification for the painful ongoing price. And this is why we quit the National Unity Government today. With a heavy heart, yet we feel that it is the right decision. We are now in the midst of a campaign that will impact the fate of Israel generations ahead. In order to guarantee true victory this coming fall, when it will be the one-year anniversary of this disaster, we should go for elections and reach a new government.
Mr. Gantz had been expected to resign on Saturday, but delayed his announcement as news broke of the Israeli military's rescue of four hostages from Hamas captivity in Gaza. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, is following developments. He gave us this update.
It had been widely anticipated that he was going to make this announcement, but he postponed a press conference because of the raid that was taking place in the centre of Gaza. And he's gone through with his threat to quit the war cabinet, which he's been saying he's going to do for some time. And he's gone through with that tonight. He accused Mr. Netanyahu of putting political interests ahead of the return of hostages, and he's called for elections to take place in the autumn.
So what effect will his move have?
Well, it won't bring Prime Minister Netanyahu's coalition government down, but what it will do is remove that sense of unity, and it will, to some extent, isolate Mr. Netanyahu and give the more right-wing extreme members of his coalition a greater influence. Now, Mr. Gantz was a centrist. He was someone with enormous experience in the military, a former army chief of staff, a former defence minister. And you have to remember that in Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, there's very little experience. And he was brought in to bring that kind of experience in the wake of October the 7th. And that has now gone.
Now, going back to Saturday's raid, there are clearly very sharply different versions of how many civilians were killed.
Yes, the latest figures we've got are from the Hamas Health Ministry, and they're saying at least 274 people were killed and almost 700 injured. It is very difficult to verify those figures, and they haven't broken them down into civilians or combatants, but certainly what we have seen is the two hospitals in the centre of the Gaza Strip completely overwhelmed with patients being treated, and growing outrage in Gaza at the loss of life. Israel's military has put the figure at fewer than 100. That was its estimate yesterday, but it's very difficult at the moment to get any complete clarity.
John Donison. Doctors at one of the last functioning hospitals in the besieged Sudanese city of Al-Fashir say they've closed down the facility after it was attacked. The hospital was supported by the charity Doctors Without Borders. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reports.
For several days, there have been reports of shells hitting Al-Fashir's South Hospital, causing injuries and deaths. But now, eyewitnesses say fighters from the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have entered the facility. On Saturday, they looted medical equipment and vehicles and assaulted medical staff. This is yet another sign that there are no rules in the Sudanese war. The army's also been accused of widespread abuses, but in this case, the RSF have forced a hospital where civilians were being treated to shut down. The paramilitary force is widely reported to be backed by the United Arab Emirates. Officials there deny it.
Will Ross. The wife of the British TV presenter and author Michael Mosley, who went missing on the Greek island of Symi, has confirmed his death. He was 67. Claire Bailey said her husband had taken a wrong route while climbing in a remote mountainous area and had collapsed. A search operation started when he failed to return from a walk on Wednesday. Dr. Mosley presented a range of programmes on health, and his books on intermittent fasting for weight loss, the so-called 5-2 diet, sold millions of copies worldwide. David Sillitoe reports.
Now, the diet I'm about to go on was developed by a nutritionist.
Michael Mosley. He was, to many of us, a trusted, charismatic guru of good health. A TV producer and presenter who was always happy to be a guinea pig in the search for a better understanding of the science of sleep, fitness and weight. Most notably in 2012 when he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. His subsequent weight loss and the impact on his blood sugars using intermittent fasting inspired thousands to follow the 5-2 diet.
And it's also good for my heart and lungs.
Michael Mosley's enthusiasm for experimenting on himself had been inspired by a scientist who had proved that ulcers were caused by bacteria by deliberately infecting himself. Michael Mosley realised self-experiments might have more impact than charts and graphs, and nothing seemed to daunt him. He even once infested himself with tapeworms.
Ah! There they go. Ah! That, that is it. That is the tapeworm. You can see it. Oh, God, that is horrible. You can just see its tail and its segments waving around.
But there was always a serious point. If type 2 diabetes could be reversed or chronic insomnia helped, he wanted to test the research himself. There are many who've told us to eat our greens or cut down on sugar. Michael Mosley had the rare gift of encouraging thousands of us to actually do it.
David Sillitoe. Still to come.
Our depth at the moment is about 430 metres.
We have hardly any earthquakes. It's really stable seismically, and the groundwater conditions are good.
Finland has a novel solution for storing nuclear waste.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right!
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
This is the Global News podcast. Next to India, and on Sunday, Narendra Modi, dressed in a blue sleeveless jacket, took the oath as Prime Minister for the third time.
I, Narendra Damodar Das Modi, do swear in the name of God and solemnly affirm that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of India, as by law established, that I will uphold the sovereignty and integrity of India.
In Delhi, there was tight security for the ceremony at the presidential palace. A no-fly zone was also put in place. And for the first time since 2014, India will have a coalition government with no single party obtaining a majority. Prime Minister Modi's BJP-led National Democratic Alliance fell well short of a majority in the 543-seat lower house. I heard more from our South Asia correspondent, Yogi Tilamai, who was also in the Indian capital.
Narendra Modi took the oath of office along with dozens of ministers in front of thousands of guests. It was a grand event at the president's house, not far from where I am. And we had top leaders from many neighboring countries in attendance. So Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, Sri Lanka's president. We had the Maldivian president as well, which was surprising because the Maldives-India relationship has been rocky in the past few months. Missing, notably, were the top leaders of Pakistan, China and Myanmar. Of course, there were a lot of political guests at the event from Mr. Modi's parties, his allies. There were some members of opposition there as well. And there were, you know, other people from the field of entertainment, for example. Shah Rukh Khan, the megastar, was also at the event.
So a grand ceremony, but what challenges will he face with a coalition government?
This is a major setback for him. It is a victory that is almost feeling like a defeat for a number of reasons. One is he'd set the target really high. The BJP had a campaign saying they're going to win more than 400 of 543 seats in parliament. What they've ended up with is 240. So that's way off mark. And so the aura of invincibility that has surrounded them for the past 10 years, that has surrounded Mr. Modi, this larger than life, almost undefeatable personality, that has been dented. On the ground, the other thing is he still enjoys massive popularity. There's no doubt about that. But we've actually been in one of the states that turned out to be a big shocker for them, the state of northern state of Uttar Pradesh, politically crucial. And many people, you know, but the Hindu nationalist rhetoric, which became a major part of the BJP's campaign, it was very overtly divisive in nature. That doesn't seem to have resonated with voters on the ground. They've told us unemployment is a big issue for them, price rise is a bigger issue for them, and unless that is fixed, even if they admire Mr. Modi as a leader, they're not going to cast their vote for him. So those are the issues that are going to be the big challenges for him going forward.
Yugita Lamai. One of the biggest problems facing the nuclear power industry is how to dispose of its waste. At present, hundreds of thousands of tons are piling up in temporary storage around the world. But Finland believes it may soon be able to offer a long-term solution. Our reporter, Adrian Murray, travelled to Yrjöki on Finland's southwest coast to find out more.
With the press of a button, it's a brief elevator ride, almost half a kilometre underground, into the depths of Onkalo, where, for the first time anywhere in the world, highly radioactive nuclear waste will be permanently stored. This labyrinth of tunnels spans more than 50 kilometres. And driving me around is geologist Tuomas Pär.
Our depth at the moment is about 430 metres.
It takes hundreds of thousands of years for radioactive waste to safely decay. And this underground tomb is the final resting place for Finland's spent nuclear fuel.
Called magnetite, the bedrock here is almost 2 billion years old. And geologists think it's ideal for a nuclear graveyard.
Olkiluoto and the whole western Finland is located in a really geologically stable area. We have hardly any earthquakes. It's really stable seismically, and the groundwater conditions are good.
With the light of a torch, we peer into a dark chamber beneath our feet. Remote-controlled machines will do the work, slotting 5-metre-long copper canisters into these holes before they're sealed off with clay and a thick concrete plug. Eventually, they'll hold 6,500 tons of spent uranium, all the waste Finland's 5 reactors will ever produce. When operational, stocks of 40-year-old waste will be handled first at this encapsulation facility on the surface. Pasi Tuohima is the communications head at Perceiver.
This is the room where all the magic happens, the whole encapsulation of the spent fuel. Here, the lid is open for the first time.
Currently, most radioactive waste is temporarily stored above ground. And worldwide, around 260,000 tons are piling up. But Finland believes a geological tomb offers a safer solution. Other countries are watching closely. Sweden, France, the US and Canada have similar plans. However, Finland is years ahead. Construction of Onkalo began in 2004, following decades of planning. You might imagine few would welcome such a facility in their backyard, yet 68% of Finns support nuclear energy. And in the neighbouring town of Yyrynjoki, locals have been won over by jobs and huge tax revenues. Finland's embrace of nuclear power is a pillar of its bid to boost energy security. It also doesn't produce any direct carbon emissions. Here, it's hailed as a climate-friendly option, but some environmentalists still worry about the risks. Juha Aroma is from Greenpeace Nordic.
If you think about the emissions right now when the power plant is running, yes, it's obviously carbon-free. If you have waste that you should take care of for enormous amount of generations, so it would be hard to say that it would be sustainable.
While some countries, like Germany, have said no to nuclear, others, like the UK, are building new reactors and watching Finland closely.
Adrienne Murray. Campaigning is underway in the Iranian presidential election, which will take place on the 28th of June. The vote is being held to replace President Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash last month. Six candidates have been selected by the ruling council. The most prominent is Mohammed Bagheer Kalibaf, a former mayor of Tehran who has close links to the Revolutionary Guard. Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian told us more about the candidates.
The Guardian Council is a very powerful institution that takes its orders directly from the person of the supreme leader. And their task is to vet the candidates who are running for office. They have done this in the past, and that has been their main instrument to marginalize the candidates or individuals who are deemed to be too critical of the system. They have now allowed six candidates to run, and five of the candidates are very close to the hardline or conservative camp in Iran. And one is known to be a reformist, but a very non-controversial and non-charismatic figure.
And what can we expect from the campaign?
Well, not very much, because as you know, this election was organized in haste after that helicopter crash, which killed Iran's former president, Ibrahim Raisi. They had to organize this election within 2 months, 55 days to be exact, and there's not much left. So I don't think the campaigning will be that intense, let alone whether the public will even take it that seriously. But as precedent goes, the state TV will give equal time to all six candidates to air their views. There will be a presidential debate held between all six candidates, and then it will be left for the people to decide on polling day.
And you mentioned there the reaction from the public. What sort of turnout do you think there might be?
Well, the last election turnout was very low. Really, the threshold is 50%. If it's lower than 50%, then you can tell that the people are completely disillusioned and dissatisfied with the regime and in its entirety. But if it's over 50%, you can perhaps say that there has been more hope that some change can be come about. And that is only possible if people take that one reformist candidate who leans towards the reforms, whether they think that he can really do much in the way of changing Iran's foreign policy or the dire economic conditions.
Siavash Ardalan. The writer of Jurassic Park and many other bestsellers, Michael Crichton, has a new novel out. Well, you might be surprised to hear that. He died in 2008. But a few years ago, his widow, Sherry, found an unfinished manuscript called Eruption, and piles of research. She enlisted another writer, James Patterson, a man who's sold more than 400 million books, to help her finish it. Luke Jones has been speaking to them both.
In early 1994, Michael Crichton had a pop culture hat trick. The film adaptation he wrote of Jurassic Park was number one. His TV show ER was the highest rated. And his novel Disclosure was atop the New York Times bestseller list. After his death, his widow Sherry found a mass of papers and hard drives that contained research, unfinished work, One bit in particular stood out.
What I found was a partial manuscript in paper. So it was already printed out in paper in a file. This book I knew always existed. I didn't know about other things that he was necessarily working on, but this book I knew was there somewhere. And so it was really chilling when I found it. And when it came to an abrupt end, I'm like, wait a minute, it can't end here. Like, where's the next and the next and the next? Where's this story going to go? So I really went in search of all the pieces to hopefully find the ending. And I never did.
James Patterson, who's shifted enough copies to make even Agatha Christie blush, was enlisted to help.
Were you a Michael Crichton fan anyway?
Huge. I'd read everything that Michael wrote, all the novels, a couple of the screenplays, the nonfiction.
Crichton is known for his love of science, fiction or otherwise. This unfinished novel is set in Hawaii and concerns a once-in-a-century volcanic eruption.
It is unusual in the sense that it has these two storylines, very strong storylines, that eventually merge. There's a volcano that threatens to literally destroy the island of Hawaii, and there's something worse on the island. There are some toxic waste there that the U.S. military left. And if they get loose on the world, it's going to be an absolute disaster. And I just love that. And Michael had written quite a bit of the manuscript, but not the whole thing. And I wanted to find out how the heck it would end. This kind of book, you really don't find them very much anymore. The kind of book where you want to keep turning the pages. You want to see what's going to happen. Obviously, with Jurassic Park, that was that kind of book. But you don't find that many anymore, I don't think.
A sort of proper thriller.
Yeah. And my strength is I can keep people turning the pages. My weakness is sometimes I don't dig as deep as I should. And in this case, because Michael had done so much research and then I did more research, so I did dig pretty deep with this one. And that was, I think that made it a better book, made me a better writer.
And you've written with people in the past, although they have been living, people like the former US President Bill Clinton, Dolly Parton. Mm-hmm. How did this process differ, not having that other mind to bounce off, but for what they've already got written down?
I didn't feel it was that different. I mean, with the President Clinton and Dolly, they would bring authenticity to the project. You know, here's what the Secret Service would really do in this case. In terms of this book, the authenticity that I need was already there. There was a lot of research and the tone was there. The voice was there.
That report by Luke Jones. If Mickey Mouse had any rival, it was Donald Duck. With clenched fists and constantly either enraged or on the verge of rage, he was probably the opposite of Mickey in terms of temperament. But all that fury hasn't stopped him having a long life. He is, after all, only a cartoon character, and he's just turned 90 years old. Terry Egan reports.
With his sailor suit and little bow tie, the white duck with the orange feet and bill has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's also appeared in more films than any other Disney character. None of that, though, has done anything to temper his personality, and the fact that he's 90 years old is unlikely to help matters. Pompous and inarticulate, his first appearance was in The Wise Little Hen in 1934, where he refused to help a hen plant her corn. He then went on to star with Mickey Mouse, the smart rodent Walt Disney came up with first, but who was his diametric opposite. Viewers obviously took to Donald, though, as he went on to appear in more than 150 films, some of them recognised at the Academy Awards. He's appeared on television and in comics and video games, and with the creation of Disney Plus, Donald is as popular as ever. The man who's voiced him since 1985, Tony Anselmo, says that with all the frustration around, there's a little of Donald in all of us. And the duck has sometimes been depicted coveting the top job as Disney's star. Considering his popularity, though, and his longevity, Donald has little need to worry.
That report by Terry Egan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Brazil's unending flood. One of its richest cities, Porto Alegre, is still struggling with floodwaters that rushed in more than a month ago. It's been a national shock. Officials are still looking for bodies and warning of the spread of disease. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.